Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, we'll be talking with L.A. writer Constantine Singer. He's a high school teacher, a writer, and an all-the-time dad. He's a displaced Seattleite and an Angeleno at heart who lives in Echo Park and works in South L.A. His debut young adult science fiction novel, Strange Days, was released in December 2018 from Putnam Penguin Teen. And this is what the reviews have said. As an impending alien invasion threatens Earth's future, 17-year-old Alex Medic grapples with self-doubt, loss, and love in Singer's assured debut, entirely human in its affections, which is Kirkus Reviews. And Strange Days is an awesome read, fun, thrilling, and creative, with a wonderfully nuanced protagonist. And that's from Romina Russell, author of Zodiac series. Constantine, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sheila.
Really excited to be talking to you today for many reasons, and one of the foremost is the genre that you write in. Can you tell us just a little bit about what it is that science fiction for the young adult audience entails?
Well, first of all, I found that anything we write in young adult, the genre, the setting, the plot, that all takes a backseat to the relationships. The whole point to young adults writing seems to be to really explore the emotional elements of being a teenager. So when we go to genre, what we're looking for is something that allows a venue for the true nature of relationships with self and other to be explored. Now, science fiction in general is a morality tale, is my experience. I mean, I can't think of any great science fiction that isn't really focused on answering the great questions in life about what we should and should not be doing. Now, that's true for Asimov, that's true for Silverberg, that's true for Niven. That's true, and as far as I can tell, up and down the scale, and my book's no different.
So what in your book, maybe you can give us a short plot summary, are the themes that touch on morality?
The whole idea of the book is premised on the nature of time. And in the book, we have this young man named Alex Mappa, who is a kid in Los Angeles. If you grew up in Los Angeles, you'd recognize this kid. He skates, he tags, he plays guitar. He's a pretty typical teenager. In his world, it's near future. His world is very similar to the ones we live in. The technology is sort of evolutionary step above ours, but not by that much. And the only real difference in his world and ours is that in his world, there are these rumors, sort of internet info war style rumors of alien, they call them incursions, where aliens are coming in and snatching people off the streets. Now, these things are happening in foreign countries. There's no video. It's all internet rumor. But Alex is terrified about them because he's sure that if it happens in the United States, it would happen to him. Now, Alex's world starts to go a little sideways early on in the book, and he starts hearing voices and hearing sounds, and then he gets a letter from his future self telling him that he's going to save the world, and then he gets in trouble at school for something he couldn't possibly have done, but there's photo evidence, and he thinks he's going insane. His parents want to hospitalize him, and he runs away and eventually realizes he has to deal with this. So he goes home only to find that his parents have been murdered by an alien, and the alien is still there and is trying to kill him. He escapes. He ends up being led to a compound run by a tech guru named Jeffrey Sabazios, who, by the way, is not Jeff Bezos, no matter what everybody seems to think. Sabazios informs him that, yes, the incursions are obviously real, as he knows, but there's also another group of aliens called the Gentry, who he's working with, who are here to help us fight them off, that the incursion aliens called Locusts are going to be invading the Earth, and we have one chance to stop them. And that chance revolves around a technology he's gotten from the good aliens, the Gentry, which allows certain people like Alex to travel into the future in other people's minds and see a future, and by witnessing it, locking it in. So if they can see the right futures, they can prevent the invasion.
I see.
Alex finds himself on a team of kids who are all witnesses. They are saving the world. And then, of course, because it's YA sci-fi, nothing is as it seems. And Alex learns a terrible secret.
All right.
That's what happens.
Don't give it away, right? Because we want to read the book.
The morality is really about the overarching theme, and this is not something I think teenagers would get, but is Alex at the beginning is a very uncritical consumer of new technology and doesn't necessarily see the ramifications of the choices he's making. And the whole book is filled with these new technologies which are slowly displacing old technologies. But in the end, these new technologies always come with strings attached. And the strings attached to the stuff, to the new technology, one called LiveTech in particular, which is what Jeffrey Sabazios is selling that's how he made his money, is very much that the string is a very, very much a deadly string. What the book is attempting to get at is that even things that are on the surface and immediate, good, and convenient need to be examined critically before we accept them. It sort of comes out of watching my neighborhood get sort of destroyed by gentrification, which brought in initially a bunch of really good things that were all felt very positive for the neighborhood, but eventually led to the pricing out of 90% of my former neighbors.
So the warning about the downside of technology goes hand in hand somehow with the gentrification that you witnessed?
Well, yes, I do see a connection between the adoption of new technology, certainly uncritically, and the adoption of any change. Change is never uniformly good or bad. And by focusing on solely the positive aspects of things, we can find ourselves led into very dangerous situations which cause mass disruption. We see that all of the time. We can talk about historically or currently situations where we've done that to ourselves.
Right.
And it can happen in neighborhoods by, let's support a couple coffee shops and a couple art galleries, and pretty soon you have millionaires next door. Or it can happen with technology for, you know, anything as sort of long-term as fossil fuels to short-term, such as the long-term effects of cell phone screen time on children.
So I need to ask you what your subject is then, mm-hmm. that you teach these kids in high school. Is it connected?
I'm a history, government, and economics teacher by trade, although I've also taught English for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So
it sounds like your book is teaching critical thinking and to look at the broader picture, not just the most immediate thing in front of your face.
That would be the long-term, that would be the big hope for it, yes. Currently, just to clarify, for the last 8 years, I've been working in a program for kids who are re-entering high school or who have fallen off track. So my kids, the last seven, it's almost 10 years now, have been between 17 and 21, and either coming back from a pregnancy or they've been incarcerated or family issues derailed them or what have you. So my kids are not traditional students and haven't been for quite some time.
You know that I was interested in our pre-taping talk about whether your students have read your book.
Yeah, well, they haven't for the most part. Part of it, though, is I've been very reluctant to talk about my book at school. Hmm. It feels wrong to push my product on my students.
When authors are guest authors at the schools, mm-hmm. I mean, of course, they're invited. They're not necessarily the regular mm-hmm. classroom teacher. But students are so excited to have that role model of somebody who's making an impact through writing. I know we're all humble, or should be perhaps humble and shy about our work. But mm-hmm. my hope for your book is that you can use it with some students to have them think the way you're opening up the discussion toward thinking.
That's happening. My book is currently, we're piloting, I've developed curriculum for it that could be used for high schools, for not aligned to the Common Core, usable in 10, 11, or 12th grades, depending on how you want to use it. We're piloting it right now at a school a former colleague of mine works in. It's working brilliantly, actually. The kids are absolutely loving it. It's enabled a lot of the discussions that we really wanted to have, both critically in terms of current events, but also I wrote the book as an exemplar for both for the hero's journey. I tried to make it as clear a hero's journey as I could so that it could be used to teach the hero's journey in schools with a book that kids would really enjoy reading, that was easily accessible as sort of a starting point for exploring the same hero's journey in the books where it's more commonly dealt with, like the Odyssey or Siddhartha.
Right.
One of the things I feel really strongly about as a teacher is that we really try to force too much in with our great literature. We give these kids these incredible books, which are difficult for them to access, and at the same time, they're trying to help them access the content of the book, the text of the book. We're also forcing along these English standard ideas about critical analysis and story structure. Why not teach the critical analysis and story structure first through something kids enjoy reading, and then have them practice those skills later on with the books, which are much more difficult.
Right. I like where you're coming from. So, that sounds good. So I think that this would be a good time for you to read the excerpt you've prepared so that we can get a sense of the character and setting.
Sure. Absolutely. This excerpt is in the book is Alex is coming home after running away, and he is ready to talk to his folks about what's happening. But he discovers that things are not okay at home. The lights are on at my house, and the gate is open. My dad's truck is sitting in the driveway next to my mom's rose bushes. I take a deep breath and let it out before I walk to the front door. I search my pockets for my keys, but when I get there, I see I don't need them. The door's open. The TV's blaring in the living room. Mom, I call as I push the door. I'm home. There's no answer. Dad? Nothing. I look in the living room. There's no one watching TV. Something smells bad, like an unflushed toilet. I wrinkle my nose and sniff again. There's something else, too. Something sour. I go to call them again, but there's a package on the table next to the door with my name on it. My letter said there'd be a package, that I should open it. I pick it up. It's about the size of a book, and it doesn't weigh much. It's the LiveTech. Mom ordered it before I screwed everything up, and it's here now. I open the package as quietly as I can. I've watched the videos about them already, so I know how it works. All I need to do is put the pod in my ear, and it does everything else, even contacts my carrier to make the switch. I put the pod in, tapping it 3 times in the middle. It vibrates, then the lump begins to shift and change. When it's done, I have to reach up to touch it to make sure it's still there. It vibrates again. This time it sends a tingling sensation down my neck and arm that makes me shiver slightly. Call Mom, I think. The screen lights and unfolds even though I didn't do or say anything. Mom appears along with the picture. It rings. My mom's phone rings at the other end of the hall. I walk to the kitchen to find her. The bad smell gets worse as I enter. At first, I think they're playing a game when I see them both on the floor. My mom is curled up like a baby, and my dad is spread out on his stomach like you do when you get a big bed all to yourself. But they're not playing. My dad's shirt is stained red with blood so thick it's hard to tell where his clothes stop and the pool on the floor starts. My mom's shirt has ridden up on her back to where I can see her bra strap. My mom's phone is ringing on the counter. They're not moving. They're not breathing. I think they're dead. Adrenaline sends shooting pains down both my arms. My fingers burn and tingle. Mom! I am just bending down to touch her when something moves off to my right. I redirect myself away from whoever's there, turning to size them up as I do. But what I see doesn't make any sense. It's tall, dark, not black or brown, but dark, like a hole, almost impossible to see. Its head is pointed, shaped like a pin, but I can't tell what part of its head has the face on it. There are bumps and spaces and light spots, but they don't make any sense. It moves again, but not in the way anything should ever move. It's dead silent, a shadow without a body to block the light. The legs are long, more than two, but I can't tell how many, because it looks like it's wearing a cape that's covering it nearly to its feet. Incursion. This is an incursion. They are real. That's a bug, an alien. The thoughts all happen as I'm backing away, half squatting. I've been in enough fights to know what to do. I rise slow, keeping my knees bent so I can jump if I need to. It's circling back towards the hallway to the front door, and I turn too, keeping my eyes on it. An arm comes out from under the cape, pushing it aside just a little bit. There are a lot of arms under there, but they aren't paired up. They seem like a collection of options, like if people were utility knives. The one that comes out ends like a knife blade, and unlike the rest of the bug, which seems to just suck light away, the knife blade is covered with something reflective, slick, and wet. When it moves, flecks come off, spattering red on the white of the wall. Blood. My dad's body is between us now. There's a gash in his back, and his shirt is bunched up into it. There's another on his thigh. Get away from me! I shout at the bug, but it doesn't care. It just keeps circling me. Why did you just leave me alone? I'm near the knife drawer now. It's close. Closed, and I don't know if I can open it, grab a knife, and get ready before it comes at me, but I also don't think I have another play. I shift my movement a bit, so I'm backing straight up to the drawer. The bug follows, keeping the space between us the same. I bring my hand up slow. The bug is still. When my hand's on the drawer, I slide it open. The bug's knife hand begins to twitch, and another appendage comes out the other side. This one looks like a crab claw. I reach into the drawer. My hand is just grasping the handle of a knife when the bug launches itself at me. I scream, pull the knife from the drawer, and swing it wildly at the bug with my eyes closed. My knife slashes the air in front of me, but there's nothing there. I open my eyes. The bug stopped bare inches from the edge of my reach. It's not moving any closer, and its head is moving slowly up and down. I can't tell if it has eyes, but it feels like it's looking at something. I move my hand. The bug head's moved, but then it stops tracking the knife. It seems to refocus on me, on my head, on my LiveTech. The bug makes a sound like buttons being pushed, then another that sounds like sandpaper against metal. Together, the noises sound like frustration. I stand up. It doesn't move. I step forward. It steps back. Its arms doing something I don't understand. Then the air to my side begins to wave and turn dark. The bug leaps into the dark air and disappears. I stand up, look around again. I'm breathing hard and my fingers feel like they're on fire. Something cracks in my mind. The drain I was trying to open before begins to leak as I look at my dad. I hear my skywriting voice. She breaks through loud. You better run away, boy. Run away. I look down at my parents. I hear what she says, and part of me wants to run. I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be anywhere. I want this to stop, to go away, to go back. I'm on my knees between them. I reach out for my dad, but when my hand gets close to him, I stop because I don't even want to touch him because I'm afraid he'll be cold, and I can't handle him being cold. I force myself. My hand brushes his shoulder. His muscles give, and he feels normal, and I get a hope that he's not dead. But I roll him over. It goes away. His face is gray. I stand up. back again. Think about trying to touch my mom, but I can't. I don't want to roll her over. I don't want to see. Run! They're going to say you did it! Crazy boy killed his family! It was a bug, I tell her. My voice is just a whisper. A bug killed them. They won't believe you, crazy boy. Troubled teen, not going to buy it, so you better run. I can't just leave them. I got to call the police. Just run! Something shifts in me when she says it this time, a sudden clarity that shatters into blind panic because I know she's right. I stand there for a moment longer, not sure what to do or where to go. Run! I stop thinking. I run.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with former Seattle and now L.A. resident Constantine Singer about his first novel, Strange Days, a science fiction story written for the young adult market, in which as an impending alien invasion threatens Earth's future, a 17-year-old grapples with self-doubt, loss, and love.
Ooh, I can hardly catch my breath. One of the things that I totally admire is the way this first-person voice has captured mm-hmm. how kids feel. They feel estranged, they feel guilty, they feel attached, they feel like they need to run. And even though this is set inside a plot that has to do with the bugs and his absolute need mm-hmm. to run, it captures those feelings so well. And you must have spent a lot of time with teens, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah. I didn't start out writing YA. I fancied myself a literary fiction writer mm-hmm. when I started writing. I wrote 4 manuscripts in literary fiction. The first one was absolutely awful. And the second one was slightly better. The third one was pretty good. The fourth one was very good. But I couldn't get anywhere with them. I got responses from agents, which ranged from generic rejections to, by the time I was the fourth novel, this is fantastic, but I don't see a market for it. Mm-hmm. I'd started writing at about 38. I was 44 when I wrote this manuscript, and I was just about to give up. It had been a dream I'd had since that I hadn't actually worked on since I was a teenager, and I was really frustrated, and I was about to give up, and my wife said to me, look, you know kids better than anybody I know. Why aren't you writing YA?
Mm-hmm. I have 2 things to ask you. One, mm-hmm. one is, and we'll get back to it, if you got that response, this is terrific, but there's not a market that person could find for it, mm-hmm. that means that was really terrific. So my question yes. after my second question is going to be, are you going to continue to circulate it in some way? And my next question is, mm-hmm. has all that experience writing the manuscripts in literary fiction helped you in this YA field?
Those are difficult questions, both of them, actually. As for continuing to circulate my earlier manuscripts, 2 of them I feel would be publishable under the right circumstances, but I write YA at this point, and my agent is very clear that he wants me to focus on YA and build a brand. And if I'm successful there, then maybe I could do something else later. Mm-hmm. And I think he's probably right. I need to get known as something before I get known as nothing. The experience of writing several failed manuscripts really helped. Each manuscript was a learning experience from which I figured out what not to do. By the end, I was writing really solid stories. So that was definitely helpful. And so much of adult literature is internal. Adult fiction, you don't need massive, exciting plot points to very much generally focus on internal journey. And that's something I took with me into YA. So I think that did help me write this book. However, I'm not necessarily sure that it's going to help me grow successful in YA.
Well, let's talk about that right now, because you found a fabulous publisher for this book, and you're mm-hmm. going to have a book tour.
I'm very grateful for them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and you're doing the piloting of curriculum based on your book.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're already something, and I think your wife had a good idea for you. So let's talk a little bit about how you found your publisher and how you're mm-hmm. involved in promotion right now.
Well, how I found my publisher, it's a good story. I was found, if you're familiar with the term, the slush pile, which is where random queries that are sent to agents go when the author has no connections with the industry and no referrals.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a slush pile success story. I actually sent the query that landed on my agent's desk, I actually said sent to another agent who he shares an office with. And she recognized that it was something that he would be interested in and handed it off to him. And he absolutely fell in love with it. Now, the story he fell in love with is a very different story than what was finally published. And he worked incredibly hard with me to turn what I had written, which was definitely very much a diamond in the rough, into something that shined. And then we were both very excited. He was really excited when we went on submission, and very quickly we learned that no matter how much we love this book, the publishing industry was not as much of a fan. This book was submitted 27 times, rejected 27 times by every publishing house in the block, save one imprint at Penguin, which was Putnam, which gave us a revise and resubmit. And so we did revise and resubmit, and fortunately, my editor, Ari Lewin at Putnam, she really loved what we did, and the fact that this book exists on the shelves is pretty much because of her.
I'm going to interrupt you right now saying that this is quite a story for writers. Rejection, 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 luck. Someone out there believes in you, in your case, the agent, and tenaciousness and a way to plow through the emotional feelings of so much rejection, and support is a really big one. You were very lucky to find this. But I think that writers do have luck. This story happens.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So we don't have too much time left, and I know that you're going to be doing some reading tour events up our way. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. I'm actually coming up back up to the Northwest in mid-March. I'm going to be in Portland at the Powell's and at Cedar Hills Crossing on the 14th of March at 7 o'clock. And I'll be at Third Place Books in Ravenna in Seattle on the 16th at 7 o'clock. I'll be glad to be coming back up.
Yeah, hopefully, so if any of our listeners have heard you on the radio, they can say hello and tell you that. I would like to know how people can get in touch with more information about you and your book. Are there particular websites?
I do have a website, although it is terrible. It's the one place I have not put a lot of work in. It is simply myname.com, ConstantineSinger.com. You can find me on Facebook at CJ Singer Writes. You could find me on Instagram at ConstantineJ.Singer. Or you can find me on Twitter at Ajax Singer. And I should have it all under one thing, but I don't.
Twitter is Ajax, did you say?
Ajax Singer, yeah. It predates my writing thing. I don't use Twitter for writing. I use it mainly to vent about politics, but that's a completely separate world.
Okay. So. But we're invited to find you in all those different ways.
Absolutely.
All right. One thing I didn't ask, and you just mentioned that I'll be back up there, you said, about Seattle or the Northwest. Back up there means you lived here at one time?
I did. I grew up in Seattle. I grew up on Queen Anne Hill, went to Whitworth Elementary, South Shore Middle School, which is no longer there, and Franklin High School, graduated class of 1990. And I also have my master's from Seattle University, their master's in teaching program.
I see.
So, yeah, I'm born and bred Seattleite.
All right, and educated here. And you do mention L.A. and Echo Park as a heart place for you. Had you visited many times or just landed there?
Just like everybody else who grows up in Seattle, it seems, I grew up sort of socialized to despise Los Angeles. It was the place we all hated when we were kids. And so I'd grown up with that. And I had relatives down here that come and visit in August, and it was miserable. It was smoggy, and it was brown, and it was ugly. And we didn't really see much except their house. And I hated it. So we moved down here because my wife, Ariadne Schaefer, as an actor, and the sort of deal we had is I'd go to grad school so I could I could become a teacher, and then we moved down here so I could work to provide income and benefits while she pursued her career. And I insisted that we have a 5-year plan to get out before we moved down. This, of course, was 20 years ago. I was here about 3 weeks. We moved down in mid-August and mid-September. I had already had to admit to myself that I never wanted to leave.
All right.
I absolutely fell in love with Los Angeles. I do love Seattle, and I do miss it, but couldn't get me out of here if you tried.
Right. Okay. Well, I lived in L.A. for 5 years, a little respite from the Northwest, and I understand what you mean. There's a lot of diversity, a lot of culture, a lot of sun, a lot of excitement. So,
yes,
I'm happy to hear your story, but I'm glad that Seattle holds a place in your heart, and you'll be back to give your reading on the 16th at Third Place Books in Ravenna. And by then, our snow should be gone, and people will have no trouble finding you there.
So, I really hope so.
I know you're busy with your curriculum, and you're busy with your book tour. Are you writing another book right now?
I actually have several. I'm always writing. Writing for me isn't about writing for publication. I write because I love to write, and I'm a soldier about it. So I write every single day for a while, even if it's only 45 minutes, no matter what, I write every single day. So, yeah, I am definitely writing. I've got three other completed manuscripts since I wrote Strange Days, and I'm in the middle of a fourth. Not having as much luck convincing my agent that these manuscripts are saleable, but I'm not all that worried about it at this point.
I think that's a good idea.
Really like, yeah.
Right. Worry keeps
like what I'm writing.
Right. Worry keeps us from writing. Thank you so much for this conversation. I'm sure that there are some real gems in here for writers who need support, for readers who want to read your book, and your upbeat feeling about writing and education. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Sheila.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.